This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, April 10th, 1964, we're really in the midst of a critical period in the civil rights movement in this country. April 1964 featured a number of protests and meetings and key organizations and coalitions coming into focus and relationships building among key leaders. And that's kind of the thing we want to focus on today, a growing and deepening relationship between Gloria Richardson and Malcolm X. You probably know Malcolm X's name, but do you know Gloria Richardson? Over the first half of the 1960s, she came to be incredibly influential, deepening ties with Malcolm X and Robert Kennedy and many others, and in many ways serving as one of the main connectors, the glue in the civil rights movement, particularly outside of the South. And Kelly, let's just get this out of the way now. She's a Howard alum. You know, just,
I was already going to say that. You were right on top of it.
Of course you were. Yes, Howard alum, among many other notable things about Gloria Richardson. So here to discuss Gloria Richardson, Malcolm X, and this moment in April 1964 are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Catter Jackson of Wellesley and formerly Howard University.
I love it.
Hello, Jody.
We'll sort of zoom in down to Gloria Richardson and Malcolm X. But Kelly, you know, you read about the 60s and it's like, every three-month period feels like the most epic three-month period ever for a whole decade. But I will say, when you dive into kind of spring, early summer 1964, it almost jumps out among all those amazing periods as, wow, there was so much changing in this moment. So do you want to just paint that larger scene and then we'll kind of hone in on these characters?
I mean, there's so much going on in this moment. And it's kind of sad because I really feel like Cambridge, Maryland gets left out of the narrative. I think we think about Selma or we think about Montgomery and we think about, you know, Atlanta, but we don't really think of Cambridge, Maryland as part of this narrative or as part of this moment. And we certainly don't think of Gloria Richardson. You know, she's one of the key women leaders in this movement alongside people like Rosa Parks and Daisy Bates and Diane Nash. And her name has just gotten left out of the public memory, I'll say. So Richardson is born in 22 in Lamouche, Maryland, Dorchester County. That's the same county in which Harriet Tubman was born. And she becomes one of the first women to lead a prolonged grassroots civil rights movement outside of the Deep South. Then I think that's really important to think about her as a woman leading groups of people who are basically impoverished, who are not politically empowered, but who want more than the vote. They want the ability to be able to have jobs and to be able to make a living and to be able to support themselves. But I think part of the reason that memory has been erased is because she was so adamant about being forceful, using force, and violent force if necessary. She was pretty feisty. She wouldn't take no for an answer. You know, leaders like King wanted her to compromise, and she was like, hell no. You know, she was, I mean, I love everything about her, her personality and her agenda.
And that is certainly where Malcolm X comes into it. And I think that's this moment in the spring of 64 is where a lot of these fault lines around how aggressive and forceful to be in this movement are really coming to a head. But when you talk about the Cambridge movement, tell us a little bit about kind of, you know, her days of organizing in Maryland.
Sure. So a lot of people in this moment are pushing for, you know, what we know as civil rights, being able to vote, being able to desegregate lunch counters, things of that nature. But Gloria Richardson was saying, no, we actually have to take the movement further. We need jobs. We need employment. We need health care. We need good schools. So for her, the movement was much less about civil rights and much more about economic empowerment and really being able to feed the people in her community that were facing extreme levels of poverty, unemployment, and being at risk for health issues. And so she's really drawing a line between like the poor, the working poor, and the middle class. And the dichotomy is that middle-class Black people wanted access to lunch counters and swimming pools and recreational spaces. But poor people are like, hey, we need jobs. We need healthcare. We need good schools. And so the needs were different. And she was really calling that out to people like King, who were less receptive than someone like Malcolm X, who was all about getting that kind of power to the people.
What's so important about this story is it cuts against basically every part of the traditional narrative about the civil rights movement, that it was led by men, that it was mostly nonviolent until it changes later on in the 60s, that it was focused on civil rights and later on economic rights, that it was centered in the South and only later moved to the North. And she's sitting there in the early 1960s being like, I'm doing all those things.
Yeah.
So it changes the way that we think about the civil rights.
So there's protests against bowling alleys and restaurants and movie theaters to protest, and sit-ins, obviously, for desegregation. So, you know, that's in the 1962, 1963. You know, obviously things are changing so quickly. At the March in Washington in 1963, she's listed as a, quote, fighter for freedom, and she's honored, and she sits on stage at the Lincoln Memorial. The other five women on that stage with her were Rosa Parks, Diane Nash, Merle Evers, Prince Lee, and Daisy Bates. None of them were invited to speak, we should add. But
no, Daisy Bates. Daisy Bates does speak.
Does she
but
speak?
She only speaks 143 words. That's it.
There you go.
That's it. I mean, it.
Well, there's another episode for us. Daisy Bates' 143 words. We will do that for sure.
Yeah.
But what starts to happen in, you know, late 63, early 64? I will point out, you know, that movie One Night in Miami is set in like May 1964, somewhere right around the same time. And that's, you know, where there's a bunch of conversations, including with Malcolm X, about kind of how forceful to be and, you know, whether to break with the sort of king wing of the civil rights movement. So, start to describe those fault lines and then where Gloria Richardson, sort of mostly behind the scenes, is really sort of navigating these alliances.
Well, like we talked about in the episode with Peniel Joseph about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., they weren't necessarily diametrically opposed, but King did embrace and embody this idea of nonviolent resistance and a kind of accommodation or compromise, that you had to find a way to appeal to and work with the federal political power structure that was dominated almost exclusively by white men. And somebody like Malcolm X and somebody like Gloria Richardson disagreed with that approach. But they thought that not only was it legitimate to meet force with force, keeping in mind that civil rights leaders were having their homes firebombed and dynamited, they were being shot at, but also these were supposed to be inalienable rights, and going to the president or the attorney general with hat in hand and being like, please, sir, may I have my rights, was something that Gloria Richardson was opposed to. She says in a press conference in 1963, a first-class citizen does not beg for freedom. A first-class citizen does not plead with the white power structure to give him something that the whites have no power to give or take away. Human rights are human rights, not white rights.
Yeah, she's not wrong. You know, she's not wrong. I mean, I think that the stance that she took, it's questionable if other civil rights leaders were more upset by her being a woman or more upset that she was unwilling to compromise or relinquish some of the ideas that they wanted to push as it related to nonviolence and civil disobedience. She was like, no, we're done asking. Now we're demanding. We're requiring that, you know, meet our needs or else.
This relationship between her and Malcolm X, let's talk a little bit about that. There's a quote in March of 64 when clearly they're starting to, you know, they met, I think, in the end of the year before, they're starting to build some alliances here. But there's a quote in an article in March of 64 that says that she is, quote, the first civil rights leader to accept an offer of cooperation from Malcolm X. And to me, that's interesting because I'm curious kind of who took a step towards whom in this situation. You know, was she in the civil rights establishment and said, okay, Malcolm, come on in? Or was she more like, we need to take a step towards where Malcolm is?
So it's clear that they both have mutual admiration for one another. But Gloria Richardson is definitely initiating the conversation and saying, hey, Malcolm, I like what you're doing. You know, I want to partner with you. I think there are ways that we could really team up and be a formidable group of activists that are trying to push, you know, the country forward. And so she's so instrumental to him. She's almost like a mentor in some ways. And one of the things that she does that I think few people are aware of is that she gives him the line for the ballot or the bullet speech. She says, Malcolm, tell people it's the ballot or the bullet. Give them the ultimatum. And that becomes one of the most powerful speeches of the 20th century, his ballot or the bullet speech.
That's incredible. I had no idea that she was the origin of them.
So on that point, I mean, is it that she was not giving speeches, no one was going to listen to her, and so she needed to give away her the best line she's ever written in her life? Or is it like, she didn't want that. Do you have a sense of
kind of... I think
it's
a little bit of both. I think she wanted to accomplish something, and she didn't need to be the center of that in order to do it, which is also why I think, you know, we don't know about the people that prefer to take sort of a back seat to these movements that are more focused on, like, achieving the goal than they are the limelight or the celebrity that comes along with being in front of a camera. But, you know, Malcolm already had a reputation for being this provocative, compelling speaker. And so by giving him the language, it was almost sort of like cut, copy, paste. He could take, you know, these ideas and get them to the people almost immediately and have the reception that she wanted to have.
I also think it's important that Malcolm X is moving in this period as well, that he leaves the Nation of Islam, I think in early 1964, and that he starts forming the Organization for Afro-American Unity. So he also, like, they seem to be taking steps toward each other. Not that they're that far apart, but they seem to be building something in that moment that's different than what Malcolm X had been doing before.
Yeah, or sort of finding each other on the outskirts as they sort of wandered away from their previous circles.
And leaving the Nation gave him the freedom to do that. You know, he was no longer sort of confined by what he could say or who he could work with. And so this is one of the major steps that he takes when he leaves the Nation.
Women,
to partner with other people, particularly women.
Yeah, right. And you know, you can see, I think a lot of people know the story of sort of Malcolm X's quick transformation in this early part of 1964, but in Gloria Richardson, it's the same story. I mean, she resigns from the Nonviolent Action Committee in Cambridge, Maryland, that had been such a defining part of her life. You know, she resigns in the summer of 64 from that. She moves. She puts on a couple other conferences at which she invites Malcolm X to come and speak.
There's one moment before she moves that I think is really important, because we think about the violence of this part of the civil rights movement as largely being confined to the South, and particularly to the Deep South.
Yeah.
But, you know, in Maryland in 1964, there were protests, there were sit-ins, there were swim-ins, and it became kind of a clash point in the civil rights movement. George Wallace, who's this famous segregationist governor of Alabama, he comes up to Cambridge, and the National Guard come out, and during a protest they have bayonets and they use this kind of military grade tear gas against civilians for the very first time. And so this really is one of those places where the violence of the civil rights movement is happening, not in Selma, but in of a former slave state, but still technically the North.
Right. Yeah. And it's a border state. But it's interesting because when the National Guard uses tear gas, I mean, that spreads for blocks, and it has major consequences. I mean, a senior citizen dies, an infant dies as a result of inhaling this tear gas. We get to see probably the most iconic image of Gloria Richardson, which is on the cover of the book by Joseph Fitzgerald, The Struggle is Eternal, in which she's sort of shoving away this bayonet of a National Guardsman. And it's the look on her face of just like disregard and disrespect to this soldier, like, move that bayonet away, get that away from me. She's almost like swatting at it, becomes such... It becomes emblematic of like her own activism and how she was so unrelenting when it came to her demands for more for Black people.
Yeah. And you mentioned Joseph Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald said just in the last year, everything that Black Lives Matter is working at right now is a continuation of what the Cambridge movement was doing. And Gloria Richardson lived until the summer of 2021. And so she saw the Black Lives Matter activism of 2020, and she continued to sort of provide advice. She said, quote, "Fight for what you believe in, but stop being so nice," was her advice as she was watching the protest play out in 2020.
It's remarkable to think about a woman who was instrumental in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, and not when she was particularly young. She was in her 40s in the time that she's working with Malcolm X, but who would then live to see the George Floyd protests in 2020. This is really remarkable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was 98 when she died, I believe.
All right. Well, you know, let's leave it there. I would say, you know, certainly that note of just realizing that she was alive to see these new movements as well, but also, you know, I think it's just so, I don't know, looking at the story makes me realize how important it is to look at the sort of social connections behind movements and just the glue and all these ways in which personal relationships get navigated and change have such a big effect on the way that larger movements play out. And she seemed like the perfect example of that, of just a connector, you know, in all the most important ways.
Yeah. And she's successful. I mean, she gets the things that she needs for her community. They do get job training programs and healthcare and more funding put towards her community. And that's exactly what she wanted. So in some ways, you know, she proved that you can be aggressive and still successful.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Radiotopia.